very good morning to everyone. We have a motion for admission to the bar this morning as the first order of business. If the movement and applicant would please approach the rostrum. Good morning, Mr. Hendrickson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jamie Hendrickson, and I'm here to make a motion to admit Todd Church to the bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Todd Church earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame and his law degree from Northwestern University. He has been admitted to practice in the states of Illinois and Massachusetts, and this year he has clerked for Judge Bauer of this court.
Well, I think there'll be absolutely no objection to Mr. Church's being admitted. He served the court with distinction throughout this year, and Mr. Church, we all wish you the very best in your legal career, and thank you for all your help to the court throughout this year.
Thank you, Judge.
And Mr. Hendrickson, you've won your first case in the Court of Appeals. If you could please step to the clerk's desk, he will administer the oath. Now we'll move to the first case of the day, which is number 043615, Daniela Hernandez against H.C.H. Miller Park Joint Venture. Mr. Gonzalez.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Gonzalez on behalf of the appellant. May it please the court, I want to turn first to the jury instruction issue. I think that there may not be many areas of employment discrimination law that are more confusing and complicated than surrounding this concept of mixed motive. And I think it's a difficult concept for lawyers and for law students to grasp and then apply. And for those reasons, I think it could be very difficult for jurors to grasp. And I think that within that instruction, I argue that the jury needs to know with particularity exactly what it is they're being asked to decide. And in this case, I argue there was a significant, important difference between what the proffered instruction from the Desert Palace case asked them to decide and what the instruction as given asked them to decide. The instruction proffered by appellant's counsel, if you find that the plaintiff's sex was a motivating factor in the defendant's treatment of the plaintiff, then the plaintiff is entitled to your verdict. This was not only the language approved by the Supreme Court in the Desert Palace decision, but it's also closer to the language of the statute.
Well, of course, the court in that case was not approving that language as language for an instruction, was it?
I agree, Your Honor. It was not saying the decision was not really about the propriety of that particular wording. But that is, she did use, a trial counsel did submit the exact instruction. But I think that it more closely parallels the language of the statute. For example, the appellee argues that Section 2A of Title VII does use the phrase terms and conditions. And that's true. But Section 2A merely includes that phrase in a sequence that actually reads, it is unlawful to discriminate with respect to compensation, comma, terms, comma, conditions, comma, or privileges of employment. So unless that language is interpreted as merely redundant, I think the intention was those were different things. And again, in using the word treatment as the appellant wanted, it's a much better description of what's prescribed.
Terribly broad word, though.
Well, but I still would argue it's preferable to picking out two of the four terms.
Well, wouldn't it have been even more preferable to use the word employment practice, which is used in the section of the statute that Congress enacted specifically to take care of the problem of dual motive, and then, if necessary, to further define employment practice as it is used in the statute? Wouldn't that have been better than to use the word treatment?
I agree, Your Honor. I think that's probably an even better description of what it is they're really being asked to decide. I think the difference matters more in a case with facts like this one. Where a Title VII case is about one discrete act, like one firing or one promotion denial, I agree it probably matters less. But here, much of what the appellant is complaining about is being denied compensation and privileges, those other two phrases that were left out. And there's a much greater risk the jury didn't understand that that's what they were being asked to decide.
But was there really any question in terms of the argument of counsel or the evidence? The jury certainly must have been oriented to what you were talking about. What is the real possibility of jury confusion here?
Well, I think one thing is terms and conditions is something of a term that might be interpreted in sort of a labor law context of wages and benefits, as opposed to things like, and I agree that the issues here on appeal are interrelated. The washroom issue, I think, if that evidence had come in, I think they were much more unlikely to regard the condition of the bathrooms as a term or condition of employment. Whereas treatment of the plaintiff would more aptly include that subset as well. And frankly, I'm not sure what to make of the fact that the judge, when the instruction as read, it inadvertently reversed the parties. The instruction as read said, if you find that the defendant's sex was a motivating factor in the defendant's actions regarding the terms and conditions of plaintiff's employment, and that's at A197 of the appendix. It was obviously a slip of the tongue. It's possible the jury understood and correctly interpreted the instruction, but if the jurors did take that instruction literally, it is a different question. It asked them to decide if the defendant's agents treated the plaintiff that way because they were men, their own sex, as opposed to because she was a woman. So I think, I'm not sure what to make of it, but I think at a minimum, it probably made the instruction, that same instruction, more confusing. I think the two issues we raise are interrelated. I think what appellant's trial counsel was trying to do was paint a picture of a workplace that was unfriendly for women, and to appellant in particular, in a variety of ways. Had the excluded evidence concerning the physical condition of the washrooms and her complaints about them been admitted, I could argue more forcefully, I think, that instruction was misleading. A reasonable jury might have found terms and conditions has nothing to do
with... Wasn't the jury aware of the fact that she had complained?
But not about the washrooms. And in fact, I think that the defense counsel skillfully used that in their closing argument. I noted that in closing argument, counsel argued... the only complaint she had about the washrooms was one lock, because that's the only one that got into evidence, one broken lock. And I don't blame them for raising that argument, but I think it painted a very different picture than the one that appellant's counsel was trying to present.
One thing that's not in the instruction is reference to an adverse action. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for that?
As best as I could tell from reading the various discussions on the record between judges and counsel, some of the drafts had included language referencing an adverse employment act, and somehow it dropped away from the ones that were ultimately read.
Because it seems when we talk about terms and conditions or treatment, there's no, you know, treatment can be good or bad or whatever. We assume it's the negative, but normally it would make reference to the adverse action. I'm not sure where we put in. Of course, the rest of this instruction, the ones that are given, it's three paragraphs, and this middle paragraph is the one that you're concerned with. But it just seems that the factor in the defendant's actions, and regarding the terms and conditions, it would seem to be the adverse actions would have been a modifier there.
I think that's the more standard term. If I may address the excluded evidence for a moment, I think that the trial court confused admissibility of the evidence with the claim being brought. When the judge ruled that she could not present evidence about the condition of the washrooms and her complaints because she failed to allege sexual harassment in the charge or complaint. But appellant did at least allege in her charge at appendix page 4, quote, I was denied adequate toilet facilities. End quote. So she at least mentioned that in her charge. And this court has recognized the difference between evidence and causes of action in many times. Most recently in this court's decision in Ezell versus Potter, just a month ago in 400 F3rd 1041, this court ruled that discriminatory statements in and of themselves, that might not be enough to create the threshold necessary for a hostile working environment, but it's nonetheless admissible probative evidence of whether the employer discriminated in the adverse employment action at stake.
HCH, the general contractor?
That's correct.
In charge of the whole operation?
I believe so.
So the assuming then they would also be in charge of the restrooms or whatever. Would they have a role? What was the setting there?
A porta potty type thing scattered throughout the construction site.
So it was used by both men and women.
Correct.
Yeah, so everybody's using the same bathroom faced with the same conditions, right?
Well, true, Your Honor, but we argue that there is the graffiti aspect. A part of the evidence she was trying to get in was a lot of this was anti-female graffiti. So there is that element, I think, that distinguishes it. And also the fact that I guess the argument would be that physiological differences would make it more difficult for a woman to use than a man, or if an intruder came in, it's less of an issue usually for a man. So yes, they were the identical ones, though. But I think that if this evidence can't come in unless you plead it in your complaint, that it sort of places a plaintiff in a peculiar dilemma, that if you want to bring in that kind of evidence, you have to allege a hostile environment claim, even though the counsel may or the plaintiff may realize it wouldn't fly. But I really want to get that in so that I can get in the evidence to present in my other case. And I tried to give a couple of analogies in my reply brief at page 15 that I think are valid. I think in any other Title VII case, evidence that the washrooms in, let's say, an office building were filled with, let's say, racial or ethnic graffiti and that the employer refused to remedy it, I think that would be admissible evidence to prove that the plaintiff was fired because of his race or ethnicity or because he complained about the graffiti in the washrooms. So I think, I'm sorry, I'm entering my rebuttal time.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, my name is Mark Nelson, and I'm the attorney today representing HCH. HCH was the general construction manager of the entire Miller Park area. And as we set forth in our brief, they did preserve upon themselves and reserve a little bit of the work, and that's what Ms. Clark Hernandez is doing down there. With respect to the Your Honor's question about the porta potties, we had an outside vendor who came in and placed them around the work site, and then that vendor was required to be responsible for the maintenance of them and the changing of them and that sort of thing.
So when she complained, then, or anybody complains, you tell the vendor to fix them up? Is that the way that works?
Well, that's sort of the problem with the case, Your Honor, is that as this case was developed and Judge Clavert took a look at all of this, suddenly the graffiti and those kind of conditions started to be the tail that was wagging the dog, and certainly on this appeal, that was what the case seems to have boiled down to. But at the trial court level, when we were developing the case and had motions in limine on this, the plaintiff didn't bring forth that sort of testimony and make that sort of a record from which this court would be able to know the answers to those questions, and that's the problem. When we brought our motion in limine, we asked that this all of this stuff be left out, we of course relied upon the pleadings as they were, which there was no pleading of this sort of nature, and we asked and the judge deferred in the exercise of his discretion. He didn't initially just say no, you can't bring that in. He deferred that, exercised his discretion, and said, let's wait until the testimony starts. When the testimony started, the first witness that was going to talk about this, we renewed our objection. And at that point in time, it seems to me that if this is the linchpin to their case, if this graffiti and whatever that information was to have been was so important that at that point in time or at some point during the trial, somebody would have gone up there with an articulated, specific offer of proof that would have answered those kind of questions and would have... They tried it twice, and the judge was very patient. You'll read in the record, was very patient with all of this. When, as a matter of fact, when the plaintiff took the stand, and apparently this was where all the evidence was going to come from, the plaintiff was not asked any of this, and there was no request to make an offer of proof. And, of course, the plaintiff had the right to do that, and I'm certain this judge would have allowed that, an offer of proof where all of that evidence could have come forth through her, and then he could have taken a look at it. He wasn't just saying this isn't coming in. He's saying that based on the record as I know it and the pleadings, it's not relevant, it's not credible, and the offer wasn't answering the questions that the judge was asking. Who, what, when, where, why? When was this brought to the attention of HCH, if ever? And who made the graffiti? How were those questions to be asked? This is a huge ballpark in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we just had a little piece of that. These metros or porta potties were for the use of everybody out there. And so it wasn't, there was no evidence to tie any of this back to HCH. And so that's one of the areas that brings us here, and that's an abuse of discretion issue. And we believe that Judge Clavert exercised his discretion properly. And in addition, on the issue of the porta potties, again, if this was so important and this was going to be the issue that they were going to ride all the way in this case, would they not have pled it more specifically? And would they not have made that offer of proof more specifically, so that Judge Clavert could have known and been alerted to what the evidence was, and so that this court could then take a look at all of that to determine really would it have made any difference in the first instance. And we believe that it would not have. Turning to the jury instruction, of course, that too is an exercise of discretion question. And in both of these issues, we should defer. Excuse me, the law says that there's a deferral that ought to take place to Judge Clavert's actions there, and it's a heavy burden for the plaintiff to overturn that. But I think before we even get to the jury instruction question, it's important to understand that that question, that jury instruction, went to the second question on the verdict, the mixed motive question. The first question was, did the defendant discriminate against plaintiff on the basis of her sex? Answer, no. There was no dispute with respect to the form of that first question. There was no dispute or disagreement with the form of the jury instruction with respect to that question. By answering that question, no, there was no need, and again, you only go to question two if you answer question one, yes. The jury did not answer question number one, yes, and therefore there was no need to go to the mixed motive question that has become the second prong of this appeal by the plaintiff. I think it's important to understand, too, that with respect to this appeal, the question number four dealt with retaliation, and there's no dispute that there was no retaliation here. There's no effort on appeal to try to resurrect any of those issues or the proof that was put in support of them or the jury instruction. Now, getting back to because it's in the appeal, let me step back and talk a little bit about the Desert Palace case. And I think the court is right on when it understood that Desert Palace wasn't setting forth a requirement that treatment must be used. In our brief, we set forth what we believe is a starting point, which is a statute which talks about terms and conditions of employment. And part of the problem that Judge Clavert had wasn't the use of the word treatment. The problem that he had, I believe, and it's in the record, was he was concerned about the fact that the plaintiff's proposed jury instruction didn't tie into employment. And this was an employment discrimination case. And that's why he made his statements. And in the exercise of discretion, he initially thought that he would use the plaintiff's version. And it was only after lunch, after having thought about this more and probably looking at it, he says, no, we need to bring back employment into that jury instruction. And so he did that. In addition, the phrase, terms and conditions, I'm taking this now from the railroad case that we cited in our brief. That term was meant by the Congress to strike a broad target at the entire spectrum of employment. So it is broad. We know also that the Desert Palace case specifically talks about conditions. And we believe that what has happened here is that the Desert Palace case, a little snippet of that, the use of the term treatment was taken and was then attempted to become the driving point for the use of that jury instruction. We also note that in looking at this jury instruction, the court doesn't just focus upon the term of the and use of the language in the jury instruction, but also has to look at what was the argument and what was the evidence. And throughout this case, there was no question that this case primarily was about concrete work assignments and overtime associated with that. And reading the closing arguments, clearly what was being impressed upon the jury was that this case was about concrete. The complaint set forth paragraph and paragraph, and to read through each paragraph, numbered paragraph, 90% of them or more are all about concrete. That's what this case was about. And ultimately, then, when the counsel argued to the jury, there was no confusion. There was no confusion in that jury as to what this case was all about. It was primarily about concrete. And so when the judge used the jury instruction that he did, and when he made the evidentiary rulings that he did, he was relying upon what the parties had actually set forth in the record to the jury. The court asked a question about there were some comments about the use of the word defendant instead of plaintiff. The jury instructions in written format were correct, and they were all presented to the jury so that the jury could take them back into the jury room to read them. And the reason that we focused upon one lock was because in the plaintiff's complaint, after in paragraph 101, she talked about terms and conditions of employment. That phrase in our jury instruction was taken specifically from her paragraph 101 in her complaint. Proceeding back a little bit, when it gets to the violations of law, section 501, again, in that section, she's setting forth what we believe was going to be the essence of her case. And the essence of her case talked about locks on the doors. So the judge did allow her to talk about the washroom facilities with respect to locks. And that, of course, was further clarified to be locks relating to a specific period of time, which was in March of 2000, I believe. Plaintiff's counsel also referred to the Ezell case, E-Z-E-L-L, out of this circuit. Let me just say that in that case, a fair reading of that was that Mr. Ezell put in a significant affidavit at the administrative level where he identified chapter and verse about the type of conduct that he was concerned about. And that affidavit then was part of the record and part of the court's ability to review this information. We note that with respect to the graffiti, as proof that this is sort of an afterthought, and again getting back to the tail wagging the dog, there was a motion after the trial was over and after the judgment was entered to try to put into the record some information on that. Again, if that was that important, if the conditions of the restrooms were so important, then those That information should have been made part of the record so that Judge Clavert would have had that. Would he have made a different ruling on that? We can't tell.
What is it? Somebody put in the record or something, a bunch of pictures?
They tried to put that in after the fact, yes,
they're
sir.
They're around here now.
I believe...
Not part of the record?
It is not part of the trial record, that's correct. What that was is, I believe, prior counsel for the plaintiff took a look at all of this and thought that perhaps we ought to try to get the photographs in for this court's review. And so what they did is they filed a motion to supplement the record. The record not being the trial record, because that stuff, those photographs and the information that I talked about, the who, what, when, where, why, that never came in at the time of the trial. Those photographs were never part of this case. And we believe that those photographs are not credible. We don't have the testimony about them. Judge Clavert did not have the testimony about them. And we think that even if the judge, if this court should believe that he exercised or he abused his discretion in not allowing that sort of testimony to come in, we believe it wouldn't have had any difference, because in the end, with all the testimony about the concrete, with all of the witnesses being called in to talk about concrete, in the end, they answered the first question, which is not on appeal, in the jury instruction for the first question, which is not on appeal. Did the defendant discriminate against plaintiff on the basis of her sex? And the bottom line then is that based on all of the evidence in the record, this jury, taking a look at it, believed that there was no discrimination here, and so they therefore rejected the evidence of the plaintiff with respect to both discrimination and with respect to retaliation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Mr. Gonzalez, you have 4.5 minutes.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, I want to first address the offer of proof issue. And admittedly, it's difficult for this Court or any Court to assess how influential that evidence would have been without having actually heard the testimony. Here, I think appellant's trial counsel did everything reasonably necessary to preserve the issue for appeal. A rule of evidence 103A2 specifies you don't need an offer of proof necessarily once the court has ruled on a motion in limine. And as my opponent argued, this was a motion in limine, albeit an oral one on the record. And this court has ruled in Mason versus Southern Illinois University that you don't need an offer of proof. What the proponent needs to do is show three things. Number one, the grounds for admissibility. Number two, what they expect to prove by the evidence. And number three, what would its significance be?
What you expect to prove is, in effect, an offer of proof.
Well, the ideal way, Your Honor, is to make an offer of proof.
Well, no, but isn't what you expect the offer, what the proof to be, an offer of proof?
Well, my understanding, I think that would be the best example, but my understanding...
Maybe the only example. Whether you do it by description, this is what I anticipate the evidence will be, or you call somebody to do it, making that offer proof, or you do it by evidence, that's letting him know exactly what it is you expect the evidence to be.
I agree, Your Honor. I think the cases have made a distinction, though, between a formal offer proof and a description of significance, as long as it's on the record. Appellant's trial counsel did raise the issue at least three times. Right before the first witness, Mr. Simonitis, at A45, she does a brief description of, and the judge rules on the record. In seeking to examine witness John Fettig about it, she asked for leave to actually question the witness outside of the presence of the jury and actually set out the testimony, but the judge ruled that she had sufficiently made her offer of proof. At A110 in the appendix, the judge says that is the offer when she was attempting to be able to question the witness. So my argument is she did do everything reasonably necessary, I think, to preserve the issue, but I understand that still makes it difficult to assess the importance of the evidence. As they were arguing, one good example, I think, is my opponent is arguing, these weren't our washrooms. They were supplied by somebody else. Well, that, too, is an argument the jury could have heard and taken into consideration had any of this been able to come in. I want to briefly address in my remaining time the harmless error argument that they raise. I think the cases that the appellee cites regarding harmless error are all cases where this court found that the evidence was so overwhelming in favor of the prevailing party. And I argue that this isn't such a case. These were fairly evenly balanced factual disputes, I think, on issues such as the appellant's skill and ability at pouring concrete. And while a few defense witnesses criticized her work in that regard, I thought it was significant that there was ample credible evidence from disinterested co-workers who testified that through first-hand observation, they could testify to her skills with concrete. Mr. Ross testified at transcript 303 that she was very good at concrete work. Mr. LaCours at page 310 said that he used to ask to use her on concrete work and that he poured it most of the time. Mr. Swan testified at 3:30 that he tried to get her on his concrete crews, and another witness, Peter Jones, and David Anderson, one of the foremen who criticized her concrete work, did admit under cross-examination that he learned how to pour concrete on the job. And I think that's the way most of these construction workers learn concrete, is by doing, and one of the complaints that she raises, she wasn't getting the instruction and the opportunities to develop at it. I think the evidence suggests that this must have been a close case in the mind of the jury, and if they had heard about the washroom issue and if they had been instructed a little more accurately than the focus on terms and conditions, that it could have made the difference. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gonzalez. The court thanks both Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Nelson for their fine presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.